ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more. Hello and welcome to Away, Indigenous Art and Culture on ABCRN. Rudy Bremer with you. Today, archives and digital repatriation. It's a subject that affects everything from language revitalization, cultural revitalization, and the creation of new knowledge. But how do you actually repatriate digital material? And what kind of responsibilities do knowledge institutions have in this space?
As Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, we look at these collections in a very special way, in a very different way. These are not just tapes to us. They're not just archive footage. These are extensions of our ancestors, and these places who hold this are keeping places of our cultural heritage and our knowledge.
Tasha James and Nathan Sentence have been thinking about these questions, and today they're sitting down to share their insights. Then, for Word Up, Jay Minning shares a Pitjantjatjara word with a dual meaning. Stay with me here on Away. Repatriation, as it applies to cultural heritage, is constantly expanding. You've probably heard stories about museums returning human ancestral remains or secret sacred objects. But there's heaps of other material sitting in knowledge institutions. Things like images, documents, even voice recordings. Returning those materials isn't as simple as handing over a USB. It's way more nuanced. So to talk it all through, I'm joined by two panellists. Tasha James is a Wiradjuri woman and Indigenous Audiovisual Archives Specialist. She's also the ABC's Archives Indigenous Collections and Community Access Manager. Before that, Tasha was the Manager of Indigenous Connections at the National Film and Sound Archives of Australia and has more than 10 years' experience working with Indigenous collections. Nathan Mudgee Sentence is a Wiradjuri man, librarian and museum educator who grew up on Darkanyung country. He currently works at the Powerhouse as the head of collections First Nations and writes about critical librarianship and critical museology from a First Nations perspective. Tasha, can you talk us through what material actually fits within the scope of digital repatriation?
Yeah. I suppose like when we're talking about digital repatriation in the sense of returning audiovisual materials of cultural heritage, we're talking about returning song and returning language. We're also looking at imagery of ancestors or family members or even of country, landscapes, things that, over the past, I've been doing this work now nearly 20 years, working in this space of audiovisual collections and returning cultural heritage to traditional custodians. And I find it so important, this work, as is the return of ancestors and cultural objects, but even more so when we're thinking about revitalization of languages and culture and ceremony, but also cultural maintenance and using, I guess, audiovisual content to kind of be a surrogate in a way to, past, ways, our old ways, making them new ways of how our people, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, transfer that knowledge. And it's a really interesting and I think really important way that these collecting institutions can work with traditional custodians.
Nathan, I know that your aunt used to say the museum has the sticks, we have the stories. And without the stories, museums only have sticks. Mm. How have you seen digital systems provide space for First Nations communities to reinterpret cultural belongings held in collections?
Well, the first time I sort of came into digital repatriation, I was very lucky. I got to be part. I used to work at the State Library of New South Wales with Ronald Briggs and Melissa Jackson and Dr. Kirsten Thorpe. And one of the projects that I got to work on as sort of a junior person there was the Rediscovering Indigenous Languages project that they sort of put together, where it was digitizing language lists. And a part of that was, of course, to give them back to MOB. So one of the things we found pretty early on about giving them back to MOB, because a lot of them were actually written by non-Indigenous people, mostly like farmers, you know, sometimes anthropologists, you know, amateur linguists. A lot of the material actually was incorrect when we started Yarning MOB. As soon as we started giving the language list, they're like, well, that might mean that, but it also means this. Or that's spelt in a completely different way to how we say it. And when trying to help with language revitalization, it's not just that material that's helpful. It needs that sort of MOB interpretation with it too. And that's why it is important to sort of speak back to it. And one of the good things that digital systems might be able to provide that in a way that physical systems can't. One of the things I always thought was sometimes physically you try your best to you know, store things as culturally safe as possible. But for example, with language material, that language material might be part of the quote-unquote Smith collection, which contains all this other stuff. But digitally, we might be able to separate it out from the Smith collection, and it can be with all its other things from its homeland into sort of one sort of digital space that would be easier for MOB to access. Because again, like I always think that, like, I'm a librarian, so I might be have it easier to access some of that stuff because I know what to look for, but other MOB probably don't. Like, you know, they might try their hometown and not realize that their hometown had a different colonial name 50 years ago, or that even stuff from, like, say, somewhere like Wiradjuri country, like Mudgee, it might have moved from Mudgee to somewhere else. And so if we could tag that material saying it's Wiradjuri material, then maybe if you're just looking for Wiradjuri material, you'd find all that material rather than sort of having to go through the Western sort of taxonomy systems.
I mean, when it comes to actually digitizing archival material, it's obviously not just a matter of, like, grabbing something and scanning it in. There's all kinds of information and metadata that needs to be included and considered. Nathan, based on your experience working in libraries and museums, what role does metadata have on material and the way we understand it? And as a hint, can you explain metadata?
So, yeah, for sure. Well, you know, metadata is how we describe material. They say it's data about data. So that's, so metadata is how we describe. So it's incredibly important. Like, for, I guess, the powerhouse, and I guess it's common with lots of collections, some of our, you know, photography collection that we've been digitizing, the title given by the photographer contains a slur. If we just keep the sort of Western system going to the digital space, that would mean people searching for that would end up having to see a slur to actually access the material in the first instant. Metadata is how, I guess, we organize and how a lot of people find the material. So, which I might, if it's okay with you, throw it at Tash, because Tash did so many deadly digitization and describing stuff with the NFSA.
Yeah, so, I mean, metadata is so important because without the right metadata, as Nathan said, it's undiscoverable. And that's some of the issues that we're actually dealing with now at the ABC Archives in terms of the work that the Indigenous Collections team are doing around subject topics and tagging and embedding Indigenous languages within the catalogues. Also, we're looking at location. So in terms of, you know, Indigenous place names. So it kind of encapsulates all that type of stuff when we're talking about describing the content. But again, in terms of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures, it's very different in the words that we need to choose, and also the historical context of these collections, where they are quite racist. They are outdated information that we don't use that terminology or language anymore. And I mean, we also have to keep in mind that we have Indigenous staff working on these collections. So it's very important that organisations acknowledge this and recognise the cultural safety around this that's needed for our Indigenous staff. And just going back to what Nathan mentioned about the digitisation work I did at National Film and Sound Archive was, I mean, we developed a model that, to my knowledge, hadn't been delivered on before, where we were dealing with men's only sacred audiovisual content, to the point where the physical items weren't able to be interacted with or held by a woman, even to be sighted. So we were led by the senior men. So we had the senior men from Central Australia who led the team. I got permission as a woman, a Wiradjuri woman, to direct traffic. I was the project lead on it. But it was such an amazing experience where it just demonstrated the best practice in how the westernized way of archiving can work side by side or together with the practices of Indigenous law, Indigenous protocols, and just even the way we were, you know. So they were doing proper men's business with our male staff, because we had to think about ways of how we can actually respect and apply these cultural protocols. You know, like, this was a collection where these senior men, who were all like probably 50 to 80 years old, were, this is knowledge that they were protectors of, and that they had a responsibility, a cultural responsibility, that any protocols were to be breached. So to the point where, I mean, the staff, the male staff, had to sign confidentiality forms. You know, and that was about self-determination. Mm. That was about these senior Aboriginal men being able to take back some agency over this content. And also even the use of language when we're talking about, although the person who the collection was named after because of his research with the Arinda and other Central Australian Aboriginal men, even the language we used was not about these old men being informants, they were co-creators. And I think that's really powerful, and we really need to change that language. It's not about our mob being informants, it's about our mob being co-curators. And that in this circumstance, it wasn't about this non-Indigenous man coming in, pressing record, being the owner of their story. So yeah. that was amazing project that Jill also did the back end of it.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds incredible. Nathan, what happens when the existing metadata is incomplete or incorrect? What experience have you had about correcting the record?
It's something that we're striving to do, because one of my colleagues, Tammy Giselle, always says that she's really taken upon the idea that we're a truth-telling institute, we're meant to hold truth. And what we're doing now is not, and the record is not. Because we have a lot of, I guess, cultural belongings, like physical cultural belongings that we have in the collection, or audiovisual material, as sort of Tash was saying, you know, created by non-Indigenous people, or even in some cases when it's even created by mob, it's been collected by a non-Indigenous curator several years ago who was the one who wrote the metadata about it. And even the most well-intentioned anthropologists, curators, they often, if they're not being outwardly racist, they have sort of smidges of paternalistic language that just needs to be changed. So what's one of our projects is at the moment is just going through the collection and fixing up records, fixing up the way the information's being interpreted. Because again, I've heard someone talk about, you know, the collection website or the website of a cultural institution, usually, I guess, like the quote unquote digital front door off the organization. It's actually how before Mob maybe step foot in the collections and maybe how they first interact with the collections. And if we're just having this inaccurate information, this information that's unempowering or dehumanizing, it makes you feel unwelcome. So it's hard to get Mob into the space to sort of, because the collection should be for them. And if they already feel like it's not for them, they might be less hesitant to actually work with us and tell incredible stories, tell their stories. And as Tash was saying too, is like Mob look at this material differently. They'll look at it as their actual ancestors. So it's basically, to a certain point, like defamation of your ancestor have this interpretation be inaccurate. So we are trying to work with Mob to sort of rewrite our collection. Our photography collection has like slurs in its title, like how it was named contained slurs, which we've actually retitled them. But we, again, because we're a truth-telling institution, or we're trying to be, we have kept that information. It's elsewhere in the record because that photographer thought it was okay to title it with a slur, and that's an important thing, and it should be something that we don't hide, but it shouldn't be the first thing you see when you access the record. And also naming people. So many Mob in collections are non-named, and I think it speaks to kind of what Tash was saying as being informants. It almost, I think I heard a term, I think it's by Dr. Lester Rigney from like South Australia. I think he said the term intellectual nullius. And I feel like that happens with a lot of our knowledge where it feels like it only exists to be discovered by a non-Indigenous anthropologist. And I think that's why Mob are not really named in like records and stuff like that, because they don't think of them as knowledge holders. They think of them as knowledge subjects. And I guess that has all implications with copyright, which is some of the issues with, I guess not so much at the Powerhouse, but other places I worked with, like I guess a lot of state libraries have like the state library acts. So they're like forced to acquire everything that their state published in their state, and they're not meant to actually deaccession that material. They're meant to be a repository. And even in some cases, even if they wanted to, the copyright holder would usually be whoever recorded it. We have tried to change that somewhat with how we commission things now, you know, because we might get like non-Indigenous photographers still, but they might be doing a project that's Indigenous. So we'll try and make sure that they share copyright or relinquish copyright to the quote-unquote the Indigenous subjects, because it's Mob's cultural knowledge that's actually making up what the audiovisual is. So it should be them that get to own it. So we are trying to change things like that. But metadata, which, seems, I guess, it sounds like a boring term, but it actually has powerful implications.
Because it's about discoverability, and with discoverability becomes accessibility. Like, we don't know what we have if we don't have the right information to direct us into finding it. And that's one of the priorities and focus of what the ABC Archives are doing, in terms of we're delivering the Connect program, which it's a two-way program where, yes, we have the first half of, you know, identifying the content and then working with the community to return the content in digital repatriation with digital files. But the second half of that also comes the right of reply and the response to inform us better. But what is happening in the next couple of months is that we're actually hosting a community from Elko Island, Yolngu people, which came out of actually the IATSA summit last year, where I spoke in Perth about the work we're doing here at ABC Archives. And it was such a beautiful moment afterwards, because the example that I gave of some of the content we hold, I had one of the aunties from Elko Island approach me with a couple of other people. I think it was Clayton Simpson from Australian Museum as well, who came up to me and they wanted to learn more about this Yolngu material that I spoke about. And it was so amazing where that one example of the content that we hold in terms of an expedition that happened up in Arnhem Land in the 1950s was actually content and a story that Auntie that approached me, her brother has been searching for. And then from that, she was like, can you please help me? Can you please give me, you know, get my brother this content? And then I'm like, absolutely. like absolutely no questions asked. And that's what got the ABC as part of this project of giving back and creating the right pathways with Australian Museum and IATSIS. So we're very excited to be hosting the group for a couple of days in the next couple of months. And they'll have the opportunity to sit down with us. They'll get to view and listen to the content that relates to them and I guess their kin and their culture. But they also will have that opportunity to respond. So they can identify people. They can provide cultural protocols where we may not know, have the knowledge of, or not applying. And then in turn, that we'll be able to repatriate or return these digital files back to them that they can take on country, take back so they have control of access. And they're able to then not have to go to Sydney or Canberra or the other capital cities. They actually have that cultural material on country that they're able to, I guess, provide access to their mob there and then, and control access as well, proper way.
You're listening to Away, Indigenous Art and Culture on ABCRN. I'm Rudy Brummer, and right now I'm joined by Indigenous Audiovisual Archive Specialist Tasha James and Librarian and Museum Educator Nathan Sentence. We're going to jump into a song by Ancestress. This is One by One featuring Dr. Lou Bennett.
Dum, dum, dum. Dum da 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 dum. They killed us one by one, they killed us two by two, they shot us down with guns, and they poisoned the food. They spread the smallpox long, spread the smallpox wide before they came to Queensland. 9 out of 10 had died, put it out again. Taking 5 out of 10, that left us 5%. Oh, what a high descent. But they carry their flags, carry their flags, and it's an honor, such an honor, just to fly that flag. Da 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 dum da dum da da dum da dum da da dum da dum da da dum da dum. They killed us man by man, they killed us clan by clan, they gave us new demands, took away our lands. Stole my talk and they have changed my walk. And what belongs to us is still sold and bought. Still feed me poison food, give a place for the rude. They strip necessity nude so they can build an excuse. But they carry their flag,
carry their flag,
carry their flags, and it's an honor, such an honor, just to fly that flag. Da 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 dum da dum da 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 dum da dum da 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 dum da dum da 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 dum. Unceded sovereignty, this has always been home, and still the stories we keep reflect the truth we've known. But they kill us today, still take our kids away. Yeah, they carry out war just in a different way. But they carry their flags, carry their flags, and it's an honor just to fly that flag. Da-da-da-dum, da-dum, 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 da-da-da-dum, da-dum.
That was Ancestress with One by One on Away for ABCRN. I'm Rudy Bremer, and right now I'm talking about digital repatriation with Nathan Sentence and Tasha James. I want to talk about the actual act of returning archival material, because it's no good putting something on a DVD if people don't actually have DVD players anymore. Likewise, it's no good emailing a file to someone living in an area with limited internet access. Nathan, how are you thinking about the actual practical elements of returning information?
It has to be consideration. And I guess, like, we've been yarning a lot about accessibility, and I guess that you just have to think about how material is accessible. In some cases, it's the language material. Sometimes it's better to straight up print off the language list and bring them to community. Sometimes, yeah, USB. What we've been trying to do, we're also trying to figure out ways that we can, you know, maybe it has to be in some cases a link, because we want Mob to keep having it, and mediums will go extinct. So as you're saying, if 10 years ago we probably would have given them a CD, and computers don't even have CD drives anymore. And that's another thing where it's like, what Tasha's saying is like about, like, maybe we might be the best place to hold it if that's what the community wishes. And also figuring out how to give back, that might be some of the things that we might have to share, is we have expertise in some things like that. Like, the Powerhouse, for example, has a role whose person is completely about, because things are being made digitally now, how do you keep them on to the future? If Mob are making apps, for example, like, how do you preserve that app for the future? Because I didn't even realize that, you know, things like PDFs rot. Like, you think of digital...
What?
PDFs will... deteriorate.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
So PDFs don't exist forever, I don't think. Like, and I think every time you copy a PDF, the copy gets a bit weaker.
Mm.
So there's things like that which...
Nathan, my heart is racing.
And also to the cultural implications, I know Jan about his collaboration with Tash, Sean Angeles. I remember him telling a story about, like, well, if we put sacred information on a USB, that USB is now sacred. So so how we even give it to the elders is, like, the elder might have to come actually collect it themselves and travel with it, because they're the senior knowledge holder. And it's like, there's those sorts of considerations too. And also too, is like, and this is not a thing that my cultural institutions even think about, but it's like, what I think about sometimes is even how we share things, like, you know, sharing things through Dropbox. I'm like, how do we protect the data sovereignty?
That's right. And the cloud and all that.
Yeah.
And going back to Sean, yeah, because that's a really good example, where that was the Central Australian Men project, where when it was time to hand over the collection material, because these are ancestors and the information, it was highly, you know, sacred, to the point where our CEO of our organization had to escort the hard drive that contained these digital files in his backpack on carry-on from Canberra to Alice Springs, and that he was to hand deliver to those senior men, because he was our top man. Like, he was seen as a senior man culturally to escort these, you know, old men who are within this hard drive back home, and to, you know, the traditional custodians. Also, like, the questions around sort of like the challenges that presented itself with, you know, yes, digital is amazing in terms of providing access. Like, it's very quick that you can provide access. But is it the right form of, in terms of when you are returning cultural heritage? There were questions around this project of, you know, the men were very anxious about security issues of where is this information if you're digitizing it and you can't physically see what this item is. And when they're being told, oh, it goes through a robot and that's a tape, and then it floats around in this cloud that you can't see. And that was really worrying for them, because they're like, well, anyone can access our information. Like, they didn't want it. So what we had to go back to then was, okay, we have to treat this as like an analog, like a physical copy. And so, you know, things were done outside of hours so that we could, you know, ensure that the security of this content wasn't going to be breached in any way. There were protocols where the studios where they were doing the digitization, any windows were blacked out. We had signage on there that people were not to enter, that there was culturally restricted material being worked on. and only authorized people from the men's working group can enter. But going back to sort of like digital versus analog, the outcome of that was really physical items in the end. They were digital files, but they are, you know, in these hard drives that sit in locked cabinets. So they're still treated as this physical object. But then, yeah, in terms of like the ethical implications of digital, like, I mean, also the whole conversation around artificial intelligence now and looking at how that can support us in, I mean, when we're talking about metadata, like these automation processes, like what about the ethical implications that comes like with our cultural heritage and, I mean, you know, there's so many things.
I've been thinking about the ethical implications of AI transcription, like of the audio that we use. And I mean, right now there's, because we are doing some transcription for Away, specifically Word Up, and it still has human intervention. Mm. So we're still actively working on correcting that. But even that brings up its own kind of discussions around like spelling changes, language itself changes, and when we're sort of setting something in this way. Yeah, I mean, I don't have answers, I just have questions, which is why I'm on this side of the conversation. But yeah, it's been a really interesting one. We have been talking a little about this already, but I am curious about when it comes to repatriation, there is often these arguments around whether a returned material can and should be preserved to the same level as it was in the institution that held them. Obviously, in this case, we're talking less about human remains or cultural artifacts, more about documents. But preservation is definitely something that comes up. We've already started that conversation, but I wonder what you think about the idea of allowing the information to deteriorate and just that actually being part of this process.
I'm always for it, like, you know, it's again like up to the community, but I always believe, you know, when you hear stories about repatriation being denied but mob are keen for the repatriation, but they say no because you don't actually have the facility to care for it. I always think, well, it's theirs, so shouldn't they choose how it's cared for? Because maybe some stories, some of the things that have been captured might not meant to exist forever. Like, they're not in that form. They might be need to exist through an oral story that, and I think Victor Stevenson, who does all the fire sort of revitalization, the cultural burning, I remember, I think he writes in his book, he's like, cultural information shouldn't live in like databases, it should live in people.
Mm.
So I think if mob feel like they can preserve it through another method, whether it be the traditional oral knowledge transference, I'm happy with the stuff to just, especially if it's stuff that maybe shouldn't have been captured in the first place.
Mm.
I'm happy with that deteriorating and not existing in the institution anymore or existing in sort of a format anywhere else besides in the mob's bodies and their landscapes.
Yeah, I think that I totally agree. Like, I mean, if we're returning this or repatriating it, it's up to, you know, mob to make that decision what they do with it. And as Nathan said, like, there could be things that are living in these collecting institutions that should not have ever been, you know, captured, and that it needs to be returned so that therefore it needs to be destroyed. Or, I mean, you hear that in terms of cultural objects, that some cultural objects, you know, like being repatriated, well, they were never to be held captive. They were, you know, I'm in agreeance with you. And just thinking about some of the, I've been part of projects that Jill also, with the National Film and Sound Archive, where it wasn't just about the return, but we needed to make sure that we were providing guidance and support in how we can assist the communities for longevity of this information. And I mean, that's the amazing thing with that Central Australian Aboriginal Men's Project was what the outcome of that was, that they now have a digitisation studio within their research centre that they can hold. I guess it's for future information that they want to hold there, but also it's taking this collection that we were able to return to them digitally, and they have, you know, they can control the access on country their way through their protocols. The NFSA is just, I guess, a safekeeping house. So they don't have, I guess, the facilities yet to hold the AV collections when we're talking about, you know, temperatures and volts and all this other stuff. But that's something that in the future I'm sure that they're working towards. But then a lot of the work that I've done over the years were with Indigenous community archives, art centres, language community centres, anywhere that was a central community space for mob that they can go and access computers to look at the internet. And then what's happening, and I guess it's probably the last 10 to 20 years, maybe 10 years, there is a real sort of movement in that, you know, communities having their own archives, in particular AV. I mean, there's always been this movement of, as we were talking about, return of ancestors and cultural objects, but now they want the photos, they want the songs, they want the recordings, they want the footage. And, you know, there are a lot of really amazing community archives out there that a lot of the cultural institutions are engaging with and working with on returning content, as are we. But also they are even, there's sort of digital archives themselves that communities are taking on, like Mukachu and, I mean, an old sort of one that when I worked at IATSIS on a returning project many years ago was Ara Iritja, which is another example of these digital archives for mob to put their AV material on and access their way. And it's also not just accessing it their way. They actually have their own way of cataloguing, their own way of, I guess, working within the framework that is tailored to their needs, and it's not working within this one way of non-Indigenous archival practice. It's actually tailoring it to the needs of them and their cultural lore, I guess. In terms, I'll share with you one thing that just came to mind, and something that, you know, I'm a Wiradjuri, I'm a black fellow working in this space, but you know, I was even sort of taken back when, because I used to go out to communities, I would look at their facilities in terms of what, you know, they had, if they had sort of areas where they can keep their collections, look at the temperature, all of this stuff, you know, in terms of, I'm going to say, a non-Indigenous keeping place. And then I would look at the collections, the size, and sort of look at what they had, what they held. And this particular community had women's business. So because I knew that they had a non-Indigenous male as the manager of the media org, went in there, they showed me the compactors, it was all locked, and I said, oh, where's the women's business? Oh, it's here, it's locked up. Oh, okay, where does the key live? Oh, it lives in the top drawer. And I said, but anyone can access that key? And he goes, yeah, the women know. The women know where the key is, and they know who needs to access and who doesn't. And didn't I just like have a moment, because I'm like, who am I to come here and tell them how to look after their cultural heritage, you know, just because I'm coming from this collecting institute, when they know what they need to do. They know in regards to access, who needs to access and who doesn't. So I'll never forget that. It was very humbling.
I feel like the word repatriation implies the institution is ceding ownership. But of course, when we're talking about documents and images, audiovisual material, we're probably talking more in terms of providing copies. So I'm throwing this to you, Nathan, because we have spoken previously about the usefulness of terms like decolonization. So with that in mind, is repatriation actually a useful term in this context?
I think in the way that people understand it a little bit, like they understand what digital repatriation is, or to a certain extent understand what repatriation is. But I do agree with some parts of your question where it should be about the control of the material and the best way to care for it. And I think, you know, that would be part of the conversation. I think to sort of give back that control and figure out how to best do that. And again, potentially through digital systems, that might be the way. Figuring out a way that Mob might have a specific login so they can control who can access the material. And I do think sometimes some things get a little bit overused, say, I guess, the term digital repatriation, because just recently at the Powerhouse, we were looking through old exhibition content that's on videotape that was part of, like, you know, exhibitions in the 90s, and we digitized that because we need to. It has, as Tash was saying, that audiovisual material has such important cultural knowledge. So we digitized some of it, and one of it was about this exhibition from the South Coast, and we were like, oh, you know, this was done in the 90s. A lot of those mob are probably still around. Let's just give them back copies. And we were lucky to one of the old phone numbers still worked from that time in the records. So, you know, we rang someone, asked if they want the material. They're like, we're coming through Sydney just in a couple of days. Could you put it on USB for us? And we did, and we gave it to them. We do have a repatriation policy. So we're like, even though this is not technically our collection, this is part of our institutional archive, we will start a conversation around giving this, actually taking this material from our collection and giving you the originals, if that's one. And they were like, no, we kind of did this for an exhibition, so we're happy with it. But I guess as other cases go along, that could be what we need to do to actually really honour what the mob want, their own sovereignty. Yeah, so we gave this lady a USB, and then one of our colleagues was like, oh, Nathan's involved in this really important digital repatriation project. And it probably is, but at the time I was just like, I just put it on a USB and gave it to Auntie because she was coming through town. It's good to have a conversation about what it could mean, because I think there's always a conversation about the power of the cultural institution. If we're not ceding some of that power, I think it can be, it's like, what are we doing this for? And I think in some cases it might be that we still care for it, but under mob's protocols or who they want to access it.
I add to that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally agree with what Nathan's saying. And I mean, even to the point where we have a digital repatriation program here at the ABC, but being aware of, like, the words digital repatriation, we actually have also added to that, it's a giving back program. And then we also are looking at, like, it's not just about just giving back the content, it's also what happens next. And it's also providing that right of reply to those traditional custodians of that knowledge that we are returning, for them to be able to have that opportunity, right of reply, and respond and reframe and reimagine, I guess, through an Indigenous lens of what the true, I suppose, essence of that content is. Because as Nathan mentioned, a lot of these, I guess, AV material have been created by non-Indigenous interviewers or anthropologists. I mean, whoever, we've got it, 90 years of content in our ABC Archives of Australia. It's not just about giving it back. It's about having that right of reply so that we can be informed better if we are holding on to these type of collection material, that we want to make sure that we're doing it proper way. So we have to make sure that we're informed better in terms of cultural protocols, how we're safe keeping this, if we are keeping it. So when we are talking about repatriation, one does think that, okay, we're taking it out of the collection and we're giving it back. But in these cases, sometimes not everyone has the facilities to be able to care for this AV material. So a project I worked on previous to the ABC with the Central Australian Aboriginal Men's Project, and it was, we called it, rather than the collection being called by the non-Indigenous anthropologist who, I guess, co-created with the Arunda, we took it upon that we wanted to call it the Central Australian Aboriginal Men's Digital Collection. So that there was some ownership and agency for these elders in terms of their ancestors being in that content and that project. Yeah, it was a pretty amazing experience in terms of the benchmark we set in developing protocols where Indigenous knowledges led, westernised way of archiving and sort of demonstrated that it's not just one way, it's two ways. I think that's really important in this setting that we have those co-design, you know, of projects and giving back.
You've kind of taken me exactly where I wanted to go next, which was like regardless of what we call this process, I'm curious about the responsibility you see institutions like the ABC playing in the conversation.
Yeah. Where I see cultural institutions, collecting agencies, even private collectors, they hold a responsibility in making these collections, these cultural materials available and discoverable and accessible for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who, as you know, I've said it many times that as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, we look at these collections in a very special way, in a very different way. These are not just tapes to us. They're not just archive footage. These are extensions of our ancestors, and they actually are, I guess, these places who hold this are keeping places of our cultural heritage and our knowledge. So as I've said, like I've been doing this for a very long time, and I've always been, you know, always a strong advocate in providing access to this content and also free of charge. There should not be any barriers, institutional barriers, as particularly I feel any sort of monetary that I guess stop access to the traditional custodians of this content and, you know, to their old people, to our stories, to our language. Cultural heritage shouldn't be for sale.
That's such a, I mean, that's a t-shirt right there.
But it's true, right?
It is.
There's so much these ethical dilemmas, and I mean, we're always challenged working in archives and libraries and museums where we're working in spaces that are, I guess, colonial structures, the buildings themselves, but also, I guess, how we do things, as we mentioned before, these westernised, you know, frameworks that we work within. And that's why it's so important that we need to have that engagement, that strong engagement, that the relationships with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities who are part of this content, because whose story are we telling? Who owns this story? For such a long time, our people have had stories about us and not necessarily by us. Or over the years, you know, we come across, it's very common to come across stories or recordings where it's all about our mob, but our mob's nowhere there. Our voices are not there. We've got the power to change the narrative. Like in terms of how Australia and the world see us as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, I believe that, you know, the story that has been represented or told about us is not the correct story. And the answers are in these contacts when we give that, you know, right of reply to mob, where that we can tell our own stories, we can amplify our voices, you know, we are truth telling. And I think the power is in these collections, in terms, especially when you work for a broadcaster. It's just about getting our mob telling their own story so that we represent our own stories.
That was ABC's Tasha James and librarian and museum educator Nathan Sentence. Tasha is the Archives, Indigenous Collections and Community Access Manager here at ABC. And Nathan works at the Powerhouse Museum as Head of Collections First Nations. This is Away, Indigenous Art and Culture on ABCRN. And it's time now for Word Up. We're returning to Spinifex Country with Jay Minning one more time. Today, Jay is sharing a Pitjantjatjara word with a dual meaning.
Pukulba means happy.
Word Up, bringing you the diverse languages of Black Australia. One word at a time.
Kinagai.
Birluin.
Walta.
Kalang.
Badjili.
Ngalungir.
Bambach.
Jiangye.
Injamara.
Guram.
Mijal.
Reipiri.
Ngarguche nama.
Gani warangung.
Munyip.
Domaninialka. Wakaniniana.
Wardadoia.
Ngundingi dangan.
Wukuk.
Kuwayu.
Delkup.
Diepa.
Murupuk.
Hello, I'm Jay Minning. I'm a Pitjantjatjara man, and my language is Pitjantjatjara, and English is my third language. Pitja, since I'm a Pitjantjatjara, Pitja, people use it either way. You can say Pitja for come with me, or Pitja go, you know, go with them. So, Pitjantjatjara, you know, I'm Pitjantjatjara. I can tell a person to go with that other person, Pitja, or I can tell that person to come with me or come to me and sit out with me. It's Pitja, and that's what Pitjantjatjara is, and that's my language. I can use it in either way. As long as I need to pronounce it the way how you will have certain reaction. Like if you say in Pitja, you gotta use your hand sign to go along with that other person or call that person and say Pitja. So it's a little bit complicated, but it depends how you pronounce it. So that's how Pitjantjatjara language stands. For me, being a man or Pitjantjatjara man, and I do work with elders and all that, for me, Pitjantjatjara language, it's same like learning English, you know. When you're young, you're still learning more words and to communicate with people and socialize with people, and you still haven't learned those words, it's same for me to Pitjantjatjara. Like, I can put it in words in Pitjantjatjara, and where some young people of Pitjantjatjara, they're still learning the other words too. So it's same. It's a language. You know, even though it's English or Pitjantjatjara, that's why a lot of elder people, when they speak to people or have a yarn with people, they got a lot to say because they've learned a lot of words over the past when they were young or growing up and they're old enough. You know, it's the same. The more you grow, the more you learn, and the more language you learn and how to get along with people. So, bye, ladies and gentlemen. Goodbye.
Word Up, bringing you the diverse languages of Black Australia, one word at a time.
That was Jay Minning, our Word Up language legend for this month, and he was sharing some of his language, Pitjantjatjara. You can hear the full series of Word Up on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. And that's our program for this week. Away is produced on Gadigal Country by Mia Hull and me, Rudy Brummer. Technical production by Tegan Nichols. We'll have more Indigenous culture for you next week, but until then, why not catch us on our app, ABC Listen.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.